Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
3, 2, 1. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today...
Well, we're still on the subject of worth, but this is a totally different take.
Yeah, and this comes from our producer, Matt Kielty.
So, next, a slightly different story about worth. A story that, rather than being about how much we value our own lives, is about how much we value someone else's.
Right.
And it starts with BuzzFeed writer Gregory Johnson.
So, okay, maybe you should start with what has now become sort of the infamous wedding drone strike.
Is that right?
Was that sort of where it started for you?
Yeah, so this strike happens in a very rugged part of Yemen where there are no paved roads, no electricity, there's no running water.
It's Thursday morning.
December 12th, 2013. And
early that morning in a small village,
a group of guys, roughly 50 to 60 people,
including a soon-to-be married man, pile into a bunch of cars, and they start driving.
This is the convoy, the wedding convoy.
Now, in the lead car of this convoy was this man. His name is Abdullah Muhammad Al-Taisi. We spoke to him through an interpreter in Yemen. And Abdullah told me it was his neighbor who was the groom to be married that day. And so they were all driving up to the bride's village. Abdullah said they got there a little before noon, ate lunch, recited wedding poems.
After lunch,
they grabbed the bride
and just a few of her bridal attendants, a few females.
And they start driving back to the groom's village for the actual wedding ceremony. Now, Abdullah said that ever since they'd left that morning, through lunch, all day long, they heard this humming.
This sort of metallic whirring, this metallic thumping overhead.
No one in the convoy could see it, but they knew what it was. A drone.
The same sound hearing all the day.
It's nothing new for people in rural parts of Yemen by this point. They don't think anything of it.
It's common to hear those sounds.
Yeah, it's usually heard there.
So, they keep driving.
Basically, if you can imagine it, they're sort of winding through these wadis, these desert mountainous places.
Yeah, the road, he said, is mountainous.
They're all strung out on this rutted out little dirt track.
11 cars, single file.
Finally, they reach this little clearing.
Up near the top of this cliff, where they all slowed down and started to bunch together. Because apparently, one of the cars had gotten a flat. Some guys got out, fixed it, got back in their cars. Then right at that moment,
the sound shifts somehow. And then the missiles start.
Four of them.
In quick succession, the shrapnel is just flying everywhere.
In a blink, it's over.
People are trying to figure out what has happened. All the screaming, there's fires that are burning.
And Abdullah, his car was torn up. He had shrapnel in his face.
Two wounds in his face. One in Yemin or Yasar. In the right hand, left thigh. One on in the back.
And he says that once he saw there was smoke, his first thought was, where's my son?
He was looking for his son.
His son was there?
Yeah, a young man who'd been a few cars back from him.
Missile hit the fourth car on the convoy, and he was married with two boys and one daughter.
Abdullah said he could move, so he got out of his car and stumbled back toward the fourth car. To find his son.
Yeah, he said he found him just next to the car. Before just he died. No, he didn't talk to him. Just he looked at him and just passed away.
So it turns out that there are 12 dead. And typically what happens in Yemen is that as soon as someone is killed, they're buried very, very shortly thereafter. What happens here is something different. The people in the convoy take the bodies of the dead and they take them back to Redda,
this big town near where the drone strike occurred.
There's a video I have.
That's what you're hearing, where you see some men take these 12 dead bodies
and they line them up in the street on this bright blue tarp and they sort of wrap them in these cheap blankets. And so there's this huge crowd that just gathers around to stare at these dead bodies who are laid out in the street.
And at a certain point,
this very tiny, very leathery old Yemeni who's sort of holding on to the back of a pickup with one arm,
he stands over the dead,
sort of swaying over the bodies and just lecturing the crowd on what happened. He's just screaming at them. And so you can hear his voice start to go hoarse. And he's screaming, an American drone killed these. It was a massacre. These people are on their way to a wedding. Why did this happen? Why were they killed?
Why did they target this convoy?
Well, according to the U.S. government, they had received intel that on that day, in this convoy, was an al-Qaeda operative
named Shawki al-Badhani,
who apparently had been planning attacks against the U.S.
That's why they took the shot. And in fact, they say that he was wounded in this wedding convoy strike.
And do we have any reason to believe that?
I have no reason to believe it.
Greg spent weeks in Yemen, talked to survivors of the drone strike.
Talked to people who were there. No one knows this guy.
And Greg says the guy isn't really a member of either of the tribes that were involved in the wedding. And so to him,
it makes no sense that he would be there.
To him, this was a terrible mistake. But what really got me interested in Greg's reporting, which you can read on BuzzFeed.com, highly recommend it, is that he goes really deep into the question of, like, what the U.S. did next. Because the question is, like, what do you do in this case? How do you repair something like this? When you have two totally different cultures with two different traditions, how do you find a way to try to make this right?
Can you?
No.
I mean, historically, do soldiers have an obligation to repair the damage they do?
No, there's no obligation, but what's happened is we've actually created an obligation for ourselves.
Americans have?
Yeah. This has a really long history, a history that's
You mean
rooted,
like legally?
Yeah. A legal history.
Really?
And there's a great law professor at Yale.
What's his name?
His last name is Witt. It's John Witt.
That's me.
We ended up tracking down John Witt.
Hi, Jed. How are you?
To talk about how the U.S. first started to try to right the wrongs in war.
So what is the foundation story of all this?
That starts with General Pershing in World War I.
So 1917.
America is called to arms.
The Great War ramps up, so we start shipping young men.
Thousands of them and millions more to follow.
Over to Europe.
We're coming over. Specifically
France. And in charge of these men was a man named John J.
Commander of American forces on the Western Front.
Stern man, handsome mustache, bit of a maverick.
General Pershing's nickname was Blackjack. And
when he first arrives in France with his troops, General Blackjack Pershing,
he's got this problem, which is that he has jeeps.
Built in America, shipped to France, and manned by our men.
So World War I is the first war in which the U.S. Is shipping a lot of automobiles.
More than 100,000.
For the soldiers to drive.
Cars, trucks, jeeps.
And jeeps are really great. They get his men from one place to another.
From Paris to Amiens to, I don't know, Marseille.
But they also run into French farmers' chickens and cows, children, sometimes just the farmers themselves.
Were these random collisions? Or were there no roads?
I'm going to bet there was some of everything. Sometimes it was probably just ordinary car accidents, and sometimes, no doubt, a little French wine was involved.
So this is Pershing's problem. He's trying to run a war overseas.
And it wasn't any good for him to have grumpy civilians at his rear.
And so Pershing has an idea, which he actually borrows from the Brits. And that is, he will use
cash,
money, to right our wrongs.
Huh. And so he goes to Congress and begs for a statute. And Congress obliges really quickly. There's no sign this is a controversial thing.
But it was a genuinely new thing because for the first time in the history of war, as far as we could tell, you had a state compensating individuals. Usually it's state to state. Here you have state to individuals. And so the U.S. government starts systematically paying money for the loss of a non-American life in war.
How much?
Geez, I don't know.
It's actually surprisingly hard to find documentation mentioning specific amounts. But whatever the amounts were, it seems to have worked. We're gonna swear our debt to you. Pershing wrote in his biography that the swift and prompt settlement of claims had a great effect upon the people. So it seemed to work really well.
And is this, is the idea here that, like, this is what we would do with the drone strike victims we talked about, that we'd pay them money?
Well, it's a bit trickier than that, because the thing that Pershing got in World War I, it came with a catch.
And that is that there's a combat exclusion.
In case you just walked in, that's Gregory Johnson. And what he means is that this law, basically what it said, is that we'll pay your claims if it didn't happen on the field of battle and it wasn't a combat situation. If it was combat and it was on the field of battle, then tough luck. That's just war.
So if U.S. soldiers were driving to a fight and they ran their car into somebody and they damaged that car or killed that person, those people would not be able to get compensation. Whereas if the U.S. soldiers were driving to a bar and got in an accident, they would be able to get compensation.
But the problem is, once we get into these counterinsurgency wars,
civilians are suddenly in the middle of the fray.
Charges have been made that troops killed as many as 567 South Vietnamese civilians during a sweep.
This is, in a way, the story of modern warfare.
Air raid sirens are beginning to sound over Baghdad.
President Karzai says he's delivering his final warning to the U.S. after a U.S. airstrike accidentally killed more than a dozen mothers and children.
By the time we get to Afghanistan and Iraq, the fighting is happening in cities, so there's no difference really between the battlefield and where people live. And so the line between what's combat-related and what's not combat-related, it starts to get blurry.
And so in 2003 in Iraq, what happened was there were actually people lining up. You know, there were civilian military operation centers. People started lining up outside of these saying, my family has been harmed, I want help.
How many people do you remember?
If I had to guess, it was, you know, maybe around 80 people or so.
Oh, that's a ton of people.
Yeah.
That's John Tracy. He was a military lawyer in Iraq in 2003. And before him, Marla Keenan.
I'm managing director of Center for Civilians in Conflict.
So when they came with a complaint, what sort, is it like you ran over my chicken or you knocked out my windows?
No. Much more serious.
I mean, I think of cluster bombs. During the Shock and Awe campaign, one of the types of bombs that we were using, or the Air Force was using, were what they call cluster munitions.
Basically, John says Air Force planes would fly over these targets and drop hundreds and hundreds of these tiny little
bombs, smaller than a Coke can.
And a lot of them would land in maybe a parking lot or a field, and they wouldn't explode.
So on a number of occasions, you'd have, mostly it was kids, right? Because the kids would see it, and
they didn't know any better.
They would just run over and kick it, and then that's when it would explode.
That's when it would detonate.
Right.
Huh.
I had a lot of those, close to a dozen. And so that was a difficult one because, well, it's combat because the Air Force dropped it because they were, you know, bombing the city.
Right.
But at the same time, days, weeks, even months have gone by and this thing is just sitting in the ground. Couldn't we say it's not combat?
And this was a real question that John had to ask his boss, and then his boss asked his boss.
They eventually sent the question up to the Army Claims Service, and they said, no, it's combat.
Meaning they're not going to pay.
Basically, like, we are in an armed conflict, and this was an unfortunate incident, but an incident that happened during a lawful combat operation, and therefore, we're sorry. And that's basically it.
So I said no to a lot of people.
And so, like in World War I, with General Pershing, military officers, they started lobbying their bosses for an expanded system so they could start making more payments. And eventually the military does expand it. In fact, I talked to one of the military's top lawyers.
Brigadier General Richard C. Gross. I go by Rich. I'm the legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And he told me that around 2006, paying out these kinds of condolence payments actually became sort of a key part of military strategy.
Absolutely.
Even had its own acronym.
MAWS, M-A-A-W-S. It's Money as a Weapon System, which, you know, I'm not sure that title resonates with everybody, but
it's an interesting phrase for sure.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the idea that money can be used to win hearts and minds that help bring the population over.
And it just got me wondering, how much money makes a good weapon?
Well, I haven't, like, the U.S. military hasn't given me access to a database or anything like that. But through FOIAs and interviews, I've seen different numbers.
Marla says that in 2006, the ACLU filed a FOIA request and eventually got their hands on hundreds of claims files. And in those files, what you see are a bunch of different numbers, but one that comes up again and again.
$2,500.
$2,500 by and large.
Now, someone like John could have paid more, but that meant they'd have to run the claim up the chain of command.
Exactly.
So it was almost like there were these ceilings.
$2,500 for a life, $1,500 for property damage, and then eventually the property damage amount got raised to $2,500 as well. And like that didn't make any sense to me, that somebody could get so much for a Toyota Corolla, but you were just going to get the same amount for a lost life.
Like, I can't get over, I mean, $2,500 seems like just such a nominal amount. And the practicality of that money, of like, if you were to kill someone who is the breadwinner of a family, that $2,500 would not be able to support this family in any way.
Right. But we're not actually trying to pay full compensation, right? Like, we're not trying to say, we think if this 20-year-old man had lived to be the average age in Afghanistan, then he, you know, that it would have been $60,843, right? Like, that's not the thing.
Do you ever, you know, we had people who were killed here in an attack.
The federal government is one step closer to cutting its first checks to families of those killed and injured on September 11th.
And those people have been compensated. Mm-hmm. The levels of compensation to the New York victims is pretty high.
The range of payments for a death claim ranged anywhere from $250,000 to just under $7 million.
Do you notice that?
I do. I do. But
it is, to a large degree, comparing apples and oranges.
That's General Gross again.
Because you're talking about a legal system
where a country is paying their own victims
versus condolences in an area where there's no legal obligation to make those payments in the first place.
So that's a very different type of monetary payment.
Well, yes and no. Essentially, it's a person's life. And
yeah.
I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that there's an empathy in the number that you come up with, in the amount that you pay for someone's life.
I totally get what you're saying. The $2,500, I think it's any amount of money. If I told you 10, would you feel better about it?
I'd feel a little bit better.
You would?
I think so. 10,
what does it get you, though? In the end, $10,000 doesn't buy anything more back than what you lost.
I don't know what $10,000 gets you exactly in Afghanistan, but my assumption is that it gets you a lot more than $2,500.
But does that really help you? Is that really what you want?
Is the money unimportant to you, really? It sounds like the money's really...
I'm not a victim, so I don't know that I can answer that. To me, if it happened...
And at this point, Marla told us a story about how, before she got into this line of work...
I had several friends who were journalists.
One of those friends was a man named Chris Hondros.
Yeah, he's a photojournalist. He was a photojournalist.
And back in 2011, Chris was on assignment in Libya, moving with a rebel group, when they were fired upon, and Chris was killed.
Yeah.
And Marla says, when she found out that happened...
I wanted someone to explain to me why that happened. I mean... Sorry. I just wanted someone to explain. I didn't... You know, like, I knew his family wasn't going to get any money. I knew that these guys that shot a rocket-propelled grenade at him weren't going to care. No one was going to explain. But I wanted that.
And the money then becomes an occasion for you to say, like... Not just, I'm sorry, but here's what happened. It's the here's what happened part.
I think it's the token that's given with the apology and with the explanation.
But it's the apology and the explanation that matter to you.
Yeah, that's why we call it amends, making amends.
One of the things that is true of money damages generally is there are desperate effort to find some common language between the party paying and the victim, some Esperanto for communicating the meaning of what's happened. in a language that the other side knows matters.
That's how John Witt puts it.
Because we see it everywhere we look. We see not just apologies, sometimes not apologies at all, but we see the almighty dollar, which is both distressing and also we know it's meaningful.
But the problem is, in order for that Esperanto to work, it has to say the same meaning to both sides, which for John Tracy wasn't really about the money at all, or not just about the money. It was as much about the envelope that the money was in, or that there was a real person there to hand it to them.
I wasn't the one who raided their house. I wasn't the one who killed their daughter. But most of them, they, you know, just wanted to look at somebody who's in a uniform and say, you really messed with my life.
And that opportunity is exactly what Abdullah Al-Taisi will never get. His son was killed by a drone he never saw, operated by a man he'll never meet, on behalf of a country that still doesn't admit it was a mistake. And so the money he got, which in the end he says was the equivalent of 30,000 U.S. dollars, way more than anyone got in Iraq or Afghanistan. Still, all he can do, without anything else to go on, is just compare amounts.
He can accept that only if he gets, the payment equal to those, in America, how you compensate someone who lost his son, for example, killed.
The payment was equal.
Yeah.
Producer Matthew Kielty.
Big thanks to Gregory Johnson, writer-at-large for BuzzFeed, who started us off on this adventure when he brought us the initial story.
And also thanks to BuzzFeed editor Steve Kandel.
And to Shaib Al-Massawa for helping Matt organize that interview in Yemen when the country's going through an awful lot of tumult, and he was able to get interviews that we didn't think he could get.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you to him. Coming up, that's next.
Start of message.
Hi, this is Gregory Johnson.
Hey, this is Marla Keenan.
Hi, this is John Witt. This is Jonathan Tracy.
Radio Lab is supported in part
by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
End of message.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.